This is the 24th of December, 1991. We're at Bill Stark's house for the National Council of Jewish Women. Flo Joseph and Howard Braun will talk with William Stark. This will be our sixth or seventh tape and the fourth session. The last thing.
What's it?
You got to speak up. Oh, about $600. The last question was: why is somebody fooling around with the City of Hope?
How did you get involved with the City of Hope? The answer is very simple. City of Hope started in 1913 with two tents in the desert, 22 miles out of downtown Los Angeles. And, of course, was started by the Jewish needle trades people in California, having watched the successes of the New York needle trades people, who took their consumptives up to Saratoga and fed them fresh air and milk. And this was the technique in those days for the elimination of tuberculosis.
Okay, what year is this?
1913. And as a my parents, of course, were in the needle trades in those days, my mother being an organizer for the Neckwear Makers Union and my father working part-time for the International Ladies Garment Workers Union and as an organizer, had an interest in that institution. By 1948, my father went to a national convention of the Institute of Industrial Launders and got to the City of Hope in California for the first time, after having been supporting it for almost 35 years, decided to leave them $600 to buy a golf cart because they had 93 acres and he was in that time not able to walk too well, and he thought it was important that they have a device for moving people around to enjoy the pleasure of seeing the institution. He came back to Pittsburgh and said, okay, you guys, write me a check for $600. I said, what did we buy? He said, you bought a golf cart for the City of Hope, so the next time I go there, I don't have to walk so far. From that point on, we became actively involved, and I was invited to join the Board of Directors of the City of Hope approximately 1975, and my function was to go around the country making speeches for the City of Hope, which was a labor of love. City of Hope is a research hospital in Duarte, California, out in the desert, San Gabriel Mountains section, and there are approximately 600,000 people like me who literally hustle $175 million to run an annual budget here in 1991. Initially, up until 1985, there was no endowment at the City of Hope. So each year we started from scratch, raising $155, then $165, and $175 million. And then, of course, Mr. Beckman of Smith, Kline & Beckman finally said, here's $10 million. And that represented the first significant endowment of the City of Hope. And so the research area of the hospital is called the Beckman Research Center. City of Hope has no cashier's office. You can't pay to get in. It has 215 beds, 110 PhDs, 95 MDs, and 1,500 total scientific personnel. It's a hospital's hospital that has come up with 2,000 medical innovations in the last 10 years. And has done some extremely important initial research in a great number of areas.
We've been. Are you still associated?
Still associated, of course. I'm down in Florida raising money. We raise $3 million in Dade and Broward County. We raise almost $4 million in Chicagoland. And no longer do they ask me to go to Omaha or Kansas City to make speeches because their techniques have changed. In recent years, they're taking up an idea that I've been proposing for many years, and that is the use of the gift annuity programs. Mm-hmm. So the program now is to raise $166 million of additional endowment in the next 18 months, and of course we're well on our way.
Good.
The significant thing about the City of Hope is the fact that it's a hospital's hospital. We were the first hospital in America to use carpeting on the floors. We were the first hospital in America to use a television monitor to cover six beds. The last three presidents of the California Nurses Association are on our staff. I asked Jonas Salk many years ago, he and I had children at Falk School, and I asked him one night when I invited his son to come to Point Park to read his poetry, Jonas, tell me about City of Hope. He says, I send somebody to the City of Hope every Monday morning to see what they're up to. We've been researching AIDS. This is now 1992. We've been researching AIDS since 1981. So this is nothing new to us. We have the whole world's compendium of knowledge on sickle cell. That we share, everything that we have is shared. We deliver hundreds of papers all over the world to spread our knowledge of what is unearthed at the City of Hope. It's just an incredible institution. In Pittsburgh, we relate to a 350,000 mammary test on women going back for 20 years connected to the Allegheny General Hospital. We run an annual program in conjunction with the Veterans Hospital in pulmonary problems. we have research the cost of bone marrow transplants, and when you see $150,000 in the paper, don't believe it, because we've got that cost down under $50,000 in the City of Hope.
Anything left of the Jewish Association?
Absolutely. A critical mass. The Jews started this and they stay with it. We're now taking on Orientals and Hispanics onto our board of directors, but up until 1989, there were only two or three out of 40 board members who were non-Jews. That number is now up to eight or nine. But that isn't important, because historically the whole country recognizes the significance of what City of Hope does. Its staff consists of a significant number of Oriental doctors.
But as supporters, Jews.
We now have, in 1990, we now have a Japanese garden. You have to understand that every single bed at the City of Hope looks out on a garden.
Mm-hmm.
If you go out to Hermerville here in Pittsburgh, you'll see a spoke arrangement where every bed looks out on a garden. When I was on the board of Hermerville, I pleaded with them to send the architects out to City of Hope to see our pain control clinic, which we had number one in the country at that time. It developed that Hermerville was able to profit significantly from that visit, not only in the case of the pain control clinic.
We have by the name of Crosby.
Our international representative is Norm Crosby. Previous to that, you have to realize that there are maybe 200 important Hollywood people who will go. Danny Thomas organized the St. Jude's
right.
in Memphis, Tennessee.
No connection.
No, that's a child. That's a child.
Okay.
That's a pediatric hospital.
Okay. Excuse me.
Pediatric hospital is a small part of our program.
Okay.
Am I right to say that this is basically?
It's a research hospital that does breaks new frontiers of human knowledge, which they share with other hospitals.
And that was the main
focus since 1952. Up until that time it was consumptive, and since 52 we've been going into brand new areas. For instance, when Chumway started to do heart transplants at Stanford, we got off that boat.
Mm-hmm.
We had been on there before. We were the first. We developed Humulin, which is a man-made substance for people with diabetes. Instead of having to go into the stomach of cows to get the essential ingredients for control of diabetes, we developed in our laboratories a method of doing this man-made. And it's just been extremely important in terms of cost, in terms of effectiveness, and it's now produced by Eli Lilly under a license from Genentech, and Genentech and City of Hope jointly created this human insulin, it's called. And we make $900,000 a year of royalties on that. Up until 1999, I called last month and asked them would they please take 10% of that and put it away in the form of a deferred annuity, because it will create a $300 million additional endowment by the year 2000, and that's in the works.
Okay, that's all the time we have
the city. Right, yeah, that's the city of it. But that explains why my interest in the continuing concern. Let me tell you about my interest in music. Let's talk about music.
Yeah.
Yes, I started to play the piano for 50 cents a lesson back in 1926, 27. Then I got to Taylor Alderdice in 1931, and Laura Ziegler was nice enough to teach me in about 5 minutes how the bass viol worked. She showed me the finger position and the holding of the bow, and I went out and I started to teach myself. 30 days later, she said, "Bill, here are five girls, teach them how to play the bass." So I had to even get more effective. But I was lucky because I became proficient enough to get into the All-City High School Orchestra and had a marvelous experience of winning the state championship against Charleroi at Chumley High School in 1933 and 1934. And some of my colleagues formed the backbone of the Pittsburgh Symphony when Otto Klemperer started to put together the Pittsburgh Symphony as we know it today in 1937. Five of the kids that I played with made that orchestra, and two of them are still there in the violin section.
Mm-hmm. Who? Who are they?
The most exciting thing was that at age 16 and a senior in Taylor Alderdice, Sid Dickler, at that time a business person and announcer at WWSW, invited me to join Glenn Gray and the Casaloma Band. Mm-hmm. And that was one of the most exciting experiences of my young life. My mother said, "Forget it, you're going to college. I don't think I want a son traveling all over the country."
What instrument
were
you playing?
Bass viol.
And it's still the bass?
Yeah, still the bass viol.
Is that still your principal?
It's still my principal instrument, because what happened then was, and I found Harvey Gall down at Calvary Episcopal Church on Sadie Avenue, and I played with him and a group that he put together. I played the Easter service, the Christmas service, and then we had an orchestra that went out.
What year?
This is all in 1938 to 39 and 40, 41. I bought the bass for $80 the year in which I was getting married, and my wife was having a fit that I would spend that money for that purpose, but I showed her that I earned $90 the first year, because Harvey would pay us $5 if we played at the opening of the flower show and $10 if we played down at the Edgeworth Club down in Sewickley for their Easter party. And then, of course, Bakalenikov conducted the first opera orchestra in 1940.
Who?
Pittsburgh Opera.
Who?
Vladimir Bakalenikov, the assistant director of the Pittsburgh Symphony and one of the great teachers of all times. Bakalenikov, Bakalenikoff. He was the teacher for Mazel. I earned $21 a night for three nights, and we played Eugene Onegin, and so it was quite a thrilling experience. And I played with the Downtown YMCA Symphony, then I played with the Carnegie Mellon Community Orchestra and the University of Pittsburgh Orchestra. And all of my life, it's been just a one pleasure after another. When I went to Florida, I found a group at the Senior Citizens Housing Project, Century Village. And there he had 64 players. It looked like I was the youngest, and I was almost 70. But they had four bass players, and they didn't need any more. So I said, "Well, I've always wanted to learn how to play the viola." So I bought a viola for $250, and I started to teach myself the viola, which I now do. play. And what happened was, when we were 16 years old, we wanted to form a quartet. And I was in the midst of a six-month training taking lessons in violin, because my father seemed to adore my brother playing the violin, so I thought if I learned to play a violin, I could get a bit of additional...
You're talking about Sid?
No, my brother Carl. Mm-hmm. And so I started to take violin lessons, which I did for 6 months, and the quartet needed a viola player, so I learned how to play the viola, as much as you could learn in 1 month or so. But when it came time to learn the viola, in my 70th year, it was a very easy transference of knowledge. Of course, it's written in a different clef, and it's a third lower than the violin. And so I put the pieces together. And every Tuesday and Friday down in Boca Raton, 9:30 to 11:30, we play the Schumann Piano Concerto with an 84-year-old woman soloist, and we play so much of the music that I played in high school and college. It's been a real thrill. My daughter said, Sally in Pittsburgh said, Daddy, you're having such a good time in Florida. Why don't you do the same thing for the Jewish Community Center? I said, okay. So I got a hold of Alan Sharon between us. We organized Jewish Community Center Symphony Orchestra in 1990. And it's now in its second year. It's up to 60 players. The conductor is the assistant director of music at Duquesne University. The concert mistress is the third chair of the Pittsburgh Symphony. The first concert this year featured Patricia Pratis Jennings, who is the pianist for the Pittsburgh Symphony, and we're getting a reputation. Well, in the summertime, we go from one nursing home to another, playing for $50 or $75 or $90, and in the winter we play for the JCC children's program around the holidays and whatever else it takes. It's an exciting experience. The orchestra is well-funded, and hopefully we'll live for a long time. Let me add that among the other things that I enjoyed was, as a consequence, being the vice president and fundraiser for the Civic Light Opera for 20 years. This is also part of my interest in music. Civic Light Opera started at Pitt Stadium, playing outside under the stars, and when it rained, the concert was over. We eventually moved into the Civic Arena.
Which is why the arena was originally...
That's right. The arena was built specifically to accommodate that. Mm-hmm. And of course, as the arena was being discussed, Mr. Edward Kaufman decided that he would contribute $1 million for the retractable roof, so that you could be under the stars on a beautiful night and open the roof. But it turned out that the roof cost about $1,200 to open and close, and the budget many times couldn't afford that, so we were restricted. But it was fun because I was able to raise $110,000 a year over and above the sale of tickets, and this money was available to balance the budget and do some other things. It was exciting because the people that we associated with were interesting. One stage, if you go back and look at the board of directors, it was started by Councilman Abraham Wolf going to Edgar Kaufman and saying, wouldn't this be a good thing for Pittsburgh? And of course, those were in the days when David Lawrence and Colonel Mellon were setting the example of joining private funds with public funds. And this was another cultural attribute of the city that made sense. And of course, if you look at the original board, Mr. Kaufman became involved with General Brehan Somerville, who came to Pittsburgh to be the president of Jones and Laughlin after his war service in the Seabees. General Brehan Somerville, B-R-E-H-A-N-S-O-M-E-R-B-I-L-E. Mr. Arthur Braun, who was the president of Bank and the chairman of the board of Pennsylvania College for Women, now Chatham College, and of course the people in the Allegheny Conference, the big business interests of the
Number
city,
six.
Put together a board of directors that brought the Civic Light Opera to life and kept it going. Subsequently, chairman of the board of the City Light Opera became a wonderful man by the name of May, M-A-Y. He lived up on Beacon Street. And at a certain stage, he had remarried Mrs. Meriwether Post, the heiress of the Post Toasties and the Post Cereal business.
Mm-hmm.
And one night we were having a board meeting in his house, and the phone rang. She was a woman, incidentally, who owned that famous Mar-a-Lago down in Palm Beach that Trump now owns. Mm-hmm. And she called on the phone, and he said, "Excuse me, I have to talk to my wife." So he came back, and he said, "Well, that was an interruption. My wife wanted my advice on whether she should pay $1,300,000 to buy a plane from Capital Airlines, which subsequently became the Allegheny Airlines and now is U.S. Air."
Mm-hmm.
And this was the genesis
What's
of that.
What's his name?
His name is May, M-A-Y.
Okay. Which is the first initial?
I have to tell you in a minute. Put Internet off. I'll tell you what his first name is.
Don't mumble.
No, I don't want to mumble. I just want to recall the very wonderful people that helped bring this together.
That's okay.
Mr. and Mrs. Willard Rothwell were very active in the City Light Opera. And Emerson Hess, who had come out of the Junior Chamber of Commerce. There's an interesting story. Back at the end of the war, a bunch of young fellows were disenchanted with the Chamber of Commerce because it basically was a stodgy organization of big corporations.
Mm-hmm.
So they organized the Junior Chamber of Commerce, mm-hmm. now known to the public as the Vectors, V-E-C-T-O-R-S. Mm-hmm. But these young fellows, Emerson Hess and Ed D'Amelio and Roland Capernella, these young fellows made a significant contribution to the community by taking on civic responsibilities while they built their businesses. They were a mutual support system, which branched out into maybe three or four networking organizations in the Pittsburgh business community that are common to most major cities. I don't know if you're familiar with this, but the concept is that people of various industries would meet for lunch and talk with each other and network on how they could help each other develop their businesses.
Mm-hmm.
And you talked before about Rotary, and this was the significant thing about Rotary International. It basically started out in 1905 in Chicago, encouraging one man from each industry to come to lunch on a weekly basis to discuss his business, his needs, his aspirations, and they developed networks of self-help. Eventually, Rotary became international. Pittsburgh was maybe the third or fourth chapter in the country that we organized. And it did an amazing job on meeting once a week on Wednesday for lunch, but giving you an opportunity to touch and meet and talk with your neighbors who were in different businesses. You came out of a Rotary meeting just as you came out of the Junior Chamber meeting with a warm feeling.
Yeah, but what's the difference between Rotary and Junior Chamber?
Well, the fact is that they were similar in program.
Yeah.
The fact is that Rotary had restrictions on who could belong.
Mm-hmm.
And the Junior Chamber was a younger group. And to this day, they represent a chance for different people to exert leadership. And Flo, you were asking the
question. I was going to say, what part did you play in these two?
In Rotary, I was basically a member, encouraging other people to join. And Rotary took in women in 1989 for the first time. And I got on the phone and told them about three or four women. I was always proud of Rotary. Well, at Christmas, I would take the bass viol and we would play music for them three or four times a year. I didn't take an active role because I was doing all these other community things. But it was always to give rather than to take, in the sense of trying to promote the concept of Rotary. You had comparable organizations like the Lions or the Kiwanis.
Mm-hmm.
They came on after Rotary with specific functions at a different level.
Mm-hmm.
Lions basically concerns itself to this day with eye care for the whole world. And they sell the United States sell the Christmas trees at the Western Pennsylvania School for the Blind. They gather up old eyeglasses. They do a tremendous international job in the area of sight.
The Junior Chamber became
the Vectors.
The Vectors.
And it's a mutual support organization mm-hmm. that will show up, its membership will show up on every single board in the city. You'll find Vectors on the board
what'd
of the
have
ballet.
What do you have to do with the chamber?
Nothing. I just bring this up as another example as you watch how the social responsibility, you've heard me talk about social responsibility of American business, and this was a classic example of where that social responsibility manifested itself, with young people fighting, literally fighting, to have the chance to contribute to enriching the social fabric while they made a living. I have to tell you, even in the case of the Young Presidents Organization, that was the exciting experience, that you had the various organizations giving young people a chance to exert their influence, to develop their skills, to make a contribution to enriching the social fabric of the community.
I really like that pre-oration.
Well, I think it's important that if I can symbolize anything to this program that you're involved in, it would be trying to tell you that my whole life was trying to build a stronger social fabric while people were pursuing the almighty buck. My interest was in enriching the social fabric parallel to the economic fabric. You could almost, as I look back on my business career, I was lucky enough to be in a family business that gave me the opportunity to really get involved in developing a community that could stimulate the use of my service. If you recall, I mentioned to you way back about my father's special interest in, you asked the question, how could a Jewish socialist have such an interest in the capitalist system? And that question was asked me all my business life, and my father too. Here we are in at the edge of 1992 with the whole manifestation of what we stood for expressing itself in the breakdown of the communist governments of Russia with the parallel injection of elements of the for-profit system of capitalism.
No, it's fine.
Let me just keep developing this concept. Let me develop this concept then that is so important, because as I look back on my life, my wife would constantly say, how can you devote such time to so many community activities? And as you look at my history, you must say, where did you find time to work? Well, the fact is I worked 9 to 5, and around the clock I was my own person. Mm-hmm. But my dad taught me at an early age that if people had the opportunity to get a living wage and live in comfort, they would have the resources to buy our rental service on uniforms. Mm-hmm. So that it was
Henry Ford's principle with the Model T, wasn't it?
No, Henry Ford's principle with the Model T is, damn it, I'm going to make money, it's what kills me, and it's going to be because I'm going to produce a product cheaper than anybody else.
So he paid $5 a day.
That wasn't the point. The important thing was his religiosity turned on making the money. His religiosity turned on creating the mass product. Our philosophy was creating a setting in which people would be enriched. Eugene Victor Debs said, as long as there's a man in jail, I'm not free. I took this literally and spent my life trying to make a better world so that no one would be in jail. And the way you did that was by imparting an education and an economic opportunity to have a job and decent housing, and crime then had lesser of a place in which to live. In my early teens, I took a tremendous interest in the prison system and spent a lot of time reading significantly on the prison system. The psychologists would say a fear of being incarcerated motivated that. As I look back, there may have been something to that, because it was always a fear of mine because he had been caught stealing once, mm-hmm. and it just broke my father's heart, and I saw him cry in desperation because of what I did, and I spent my life trying to live down that horrible experience. The thought of incarceration was always frightening and probably motivated a lot of the social good that I did, but the fact remains that it all ties together into the social philosophy of strengthening a social fabric and an economic fabric that made it possible for American business and the profit system to grow and grow and grow. It made it possible for those monies to then come back into the Playhouse, mm-hmm. into the Pittsburgh Symphony, into the Pittsburgh Opera, into the American Wind Symphony, and all the institutions that I was interested in. And this is the story of what has eventuated. You have to remember that when I was a young man, these ideas didn't exist.
That's right.
Andrew Carnegie was the only one who understood this whole philosophy, and his was only based after he had accumulated the money.
That's
I had the pleasure of developing this philosophy when I didn't have any money.
Mm-hmm.
But I did have this strong drive to try to enrich the community and stick my nose in where it was possible to strengthen the social fabric.
What year was this tragic incident you mentioned?
The theft?
Yeah.
Well, that would have been, that was 1928 in Swissville. The man up the street had two sons that were in the business of making soda pop. And going down into his cellar was a covered